You're listening to Crossing the Line, a weekly podcast dedicated to giving voice to the voiceless in occupied Palestine. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This week on Crossing the Line, notable members of Congress as well as the Israeli lobbies forced Charles Freeman, a highly respected foreign policy and intelligence expert, to withdraw his name for consideration as head of the National Intelligence Council. While many in Washington spoke out in favor of Freeman, the Obama administration's voice was noticeably absent. Today, we'll spend the show speaking to two former CIA analysts, Kathleen and Bill Christensen, about these issues. But first, the news from Palestine.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for March 14th through March 20th, 2009. As the military kills Palestinians this week in Gaza and kidnaps MPs in the West Bank, Israel and the ruling Hamas party in Gaza failed to reach a prisoner swap deal. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report with the non-violent activities in the West Bank with IMEMC's Mary Arthur.
The residents of Bilin village, located near the central West Bank city of Ramallah, marched towards the wall on Friday after midday prayers. The protest was joined by Israeli and international activists. Protesters carried a huge banner condemning Israel's ongoing policies and violence against civilians, especially in Jerusalem. The protest began in the centre of the village, called for national unity and resistance to the occupation, then headed towards the apartheid wall, which is built on Bilin's land. An Israeli army unit stationed behind the wall prevented the crowd from going through the gate. The army fired tear gas canisters to break up the crowd, causing dozens to suffer gas inhalation. At least three demonstrators were injured in the weekly protest, including two from the United States. Also near Ramallah on Friday, scores of villagers from Nilin held their weekly protest on Friday midday against the illegal Israeli wall being built on village land. Along with international and Israeli solidarity workers, villagers marched towards the land which is being confiscated by Israel to build the wall. Demonstrators carried banners in support of the American supporter, Tristan Anderson, who was critically wounded in last week's protest. Anderson is still at an Israeli hospital receiving treatment. Doctors are currently saying that he will live, but with severe disabilities resulting from the injury to his head. As soon as locals and international supporters arrived in that part of the village where Israel is building the wall, soldiers showered them with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets, also firing live rounds of ammunition. Six were injured, one critically, when he was hit in the head by a rubber-coated steel bullet. Dozens were treated for gas inhalation. For IMEMC.org, this is Mary Arthur.
Representatives of more than a dozen political factions and independent parties returned back empty-handed from Cairo after they failed to achieve an agreement on national conciliation. Also, Israel and the ruling Hamas party in Gaza failed to reach a prisoner swap deal. IMEMC's Jessica Halsey has the details.
According to Walid Al-Awad, representatives of the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine stated on Thursday that the parties in Cairo failed to agree on four main issues: the elections, the platform of an upcoming unity government, the reformation of the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the transitional period between an expected unity government and elections. Sources in Cairo confirmed that the parties agreed on a date for the presidential and parliamentary elections. They are expected to take place on January 25, 2010. Meanwhile, sources said that the representatives are expected to resume dialogue by the end of this month. This week, Israel declared the Egyptian-mediated prisoner swap with the ruling Hamas party in Gaza to be a failure. Israeli representatives that went to Cairo blamed Hamas for the failure of the talks. In Gaza, Hamas held Israel responsible for the failure of the deal, saying that Israel has produced a list of would-be released prisoners that excluded names Hamas wanted to see freed. Immediately after the failure of such talks, the Israeli army detained at least five Hamas members of parliament from the West Bank. The detentions are believed to be part of Israel's plan to put pressure on Hamas. Despite the failure this week, Egyptian sources expected a new round of prisoner exchange talks between Hamas and Israel. Some political analysts suggest that upcoming talks will be harder than ever, as current Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert is leaving office by the end of this month. Coincidentally, Israeli President Shimon Peres gave Benjamin Netanyahu, winner of the Likud party, a 14-day period to form a coalition government. For IAMEMC.org, this is Jessica Holsey.
The Israeli army continued its attacks on Gaza this week. Two Palestinian fighters were killed and a number of civilians were injured during several attacks by the military. From Gaza, IMEMC's Rami El-Magari reports.
The Al-Aqsa Brigade, the armed wing of the Fatah movement, reported that two of its fighters were killed in an Israeli airstrike in the central Gaza Strip earlier on Thursday. Meanwhile, an Israeli spokesperson stated that as far as she knows, the army was not operating in the Gaza Strip or in any area close to the border fence between Gaza and Israel. One Palestinian civilian was injured midday on Tuesday when Israeli naval boats opened fire on residents and fishermen gathered at the beach near the Beit Lahia town in the northern Gaza Strip. Doctors pronounced that one man sustained moderate wounds and was moved to nearby hospital for treatment. The Israeli military opened two border crossings leading into Gaza on Monday to allow food supplies into the besieged region. Local sources said that the army opened Karim Abu Salem and Al-Mantara crossings in the southern and central Gaza Strip. It was stated that a total of 110 trucks loaded with food supplies were allowed into the coastal region in addition to 6 trucks of cooking gas and 10 trucks of gasoline to generate electricity. The Gaza Strip has been under siege from the Israeli army since June of 2007, allowing only limited amounts of humanitarian aid into Gaza, leaving the 1.5 million Palestinians living there with very little to live on. Also in Gaza, Palestinian sources reported on Monday that unmanned Israeli planes fired missiles at a group of people gathered in the town of Jabalia in the northern part of the Gaza Strip late on Sunday night. Doctors reported that one man sustained critical injuries due to the attacks. For IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Maghari in Gaza.
In the West Bank this week, the Israeli army conducted at least 39 military invasions into Palestinian communities. Troops kidnapped at least 60 Palestinian civilians during this week's attacks. This and more from IMEMC's John Muller.
Among those kidnapped were Palestinian elected MPs. Dr. Nasser al-Shaair, Vice Prime Minister of the dissolved Hamas government, Sheikh Adnan Asfour, a political leader of Hamas, and Professor Issam al-Ashkar, all from Nablus. PLC members Ayman Darahma and Abdul Jabbar Fukaha and Mazen Arimawi, head of the Ramallah Legislator's Office, were kidnapped in Ramallah. Legislators Assam Salhab and Nizar Ramadan were kidnapped from Hebron and legislator Khalid Tafish from Bethlehem. One house, two Bedouin huts and an animal shed owned by Palestinians near Jerusalem City were demolished on Wednesday by the Israeli authorities. All the demolitions took place in Al-Ezariya, a Palestinian town just outside East Jerusalem. The home, owned by Rabia al-Kamari, was demolished on Wednesday midday. Israel says the home is built on an Israeli area without the required documents, while the other structures are close to the Israeli wall being built there.
My house is legal. I have all needed documents. Anyway, the house is built in a Palestinian-controlled area, not in an Israeli area. When my son asked them for the demolition order, they beat him up.
Also in Jerusalem, bulldozers belonging to the Israeli municipality demolished a Palestinian-owned flat located in the Beit Safafa neighborhood in the city on Tuesday. In related news, this week, Israel has handed out 80 new demolition orders to homes owned by Palestinians in Jerusalem City. Israel has intensified its campaign of demolition of Palestinian-owned homes. The Jerusalem municipality handed out demolition orders to 96 Palestinian families in the first week of March, while another 88 such orders were handed out in February. Since Israel occupied the city of Jerusalem in 1967, the authorities have rarely given Palestinian residents permission to build homes. The Israeli government has continued to build Jewish settlements in and around Jerusalem, an act which violates international law. Staying in Jerusalem, the Israeli Supreme Court gave the go-ahead to the Israeli authorities to raise the home of the East Jerusalem Palestinian who carried a bulldozer attack in the city in July of 2008. The decision came after the court rejected a petition filed by Tassir Bekat, the father of Hussam, who carried out the attack and was shot dead. Three Israelis were killed and several others were injured in the attack. A 24-year-old Palestinian woman sustained moderate wounds after she was attacked by settlers near Hebron, medical sources reported. The young woman's family reported that she was on her way back home in Hebron City when settlers from a nearby illegal settlement threw stones at her. The residents say that the settlers attacked them frequently, sometimes aided by the military. For IMEMC.org, this is John Müller.
That's just some of the news this week in Palestine. For constant updates, please check out our website, www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This week's report has been brought to you by Jenna Orwell and Kassan Benora.
In Berkeley, I'm Najee Ali, and you're listening to Crossing the Line. Former U.S. Ambassador Charles Chaz Freeman withdrew his name for the job of the nation's top intelligence analyst after he came under Republican-led opposition over his comments criticizing Israel's occupation of Palestinian land. Some Democrats joined in on the opposition to Freeman's appointment. In a statement, Democratic Senator Charles Schumer took credit for Freeman's withdrawal, saying, quote, "I repeatedly urged the White House to reject him, and I'm glad they did the right thing," close quote. In a statement, Freeman blasted lobby groups, lawmakers, and pundits who support Israeli government policies for forcing his withdrawal. Freeman wrote, quote, "The tactics of the Israeli lobby plumb the depths of dishonor and indecency. The aim of this lobby is to control of the policy process through the exercise of a veto over the appointment of people who dispute the wisdom of its views. The substitution of political correctness for analysis and the exclusion of any and all oppositions for decision by Americans and our government other than those that it favors," close quote. Zionist groups, neocons, and the Christian right have all hailed the rejection of Freeman to the National Intelligence Council, while those who support Palestinian self-determination look on in worried fascination as yet another fair-minded foreign policy expert is brushed aside due to his criticism of Israel's occupation of Palestinian land. With us to talk about these recent events are Crossing the Line's good friends Kathleen and Bill Christensen. Kathleen Christensen is a former CIA political analyst who has worked on Middle East issues for over 35 years. She is the author of Perceptions of Palestine and The Wound of Dispossession. Bill Christensen is a former senior official of the CIA. He served as a national intelligence officer and as director of the CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis. Kathleen and Bill, welcome back to Crossing the Line.
Thank you, Najee.
Thank
good
you very
here.
Much.
Bill, let's begin with you. Can you talk briefly about the function and the importance of the National Intelligence Council? And as I understand it, you served on this council when you were in the agency, correct?
Well, that's absolutely correct. Actually, I was one of the first 10 or 12 national intelligence officers. The system only started in the early 1970s, and there was not anything named the National Intelligence Council at that time. But that changed, and quite rapidly, the director of the National Intelligence Council became the man in charge of all the national intelligence officers, all of whom were people who chaired national intelligence estimates in their particular area as a national intelligence officer. So were I still a neat young man with all my brains still about me and still working, Freeman would have been my immediate superior. And through him, every one of the national intelligence officers has, for his area of the world, direct access whenever he wants it. Previously to the Director of Central Intelligence, but now to the Director of National Intelligence. So, I think it is a great, great tragedy that he didn't get the job, and I think there is no one more to blame for that than the President of the United States. I think one of his top advisors appointed Freeman, and there was not one word of support for Freeman coming out of the White House that I ever saw or heard.
And, you know, if I can jump in, this whole thing went on for 3 weeks before Freeman finally withdrew. The lobby flax, I would have to call them, started attacking him 3 weeks when his appointment was first rumored, even before he was actually appointed. Then after he was formally appointed, and then for a week or so after that before he withdrew. And so the notion that Obama was taken by surprise on this or anything like that is just absurd. He just didn't want to get into a fight with the Israel lobby, and he finally decided to lose the fight.
The only good thing that comes out of this is this experience makes it crystal clear that there is a very powerful Israel lobby in this country, and as you know probably every bit as well as we, there are some people who are supposedly progressive who have made the argument over the last few years that there really is no extraordinarily powerful Israel lobby. Well, here's an example that I think no one can stand up now and say there really is not a powerful Israel lobby. That's a good thing to come out of this, and if it does nothing more than intensify debate about how the U.S. government and its intelligence apparatus is organized and how there has got to be a great deal of independence in that intelligence apparatus, you know, it'll be a very good thing if such debate comes out of this.
Now, as I understand it, there are 16 agencies that would be governed by the person who heads the Intelligence Council, at least to my knowledge, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Do you think that these lobbies, and I do agree with you that they are extremely powerful and that they do exist, this is just one of the many facts that has been proven that they do. Do you think that not only these lobbies have been able to make comments or suggestions or even block the appointment of such a person such as Chas Freeman, but also can also prevent others from different agencies within these 16 from being appointed as well?
You know, I think that is the case. I think more the case is the fact that just seeing what has happened here makes an awful lot of middle-level bureaucrats in the U.S. government read the handwriting on the wall, and they will all self-censor themselves in ways that do not do benefit to the United States government and what it should be standing for.
Kathy, now we're not talking about a man who has no foreign policy experience. Chas Freeman is a former ambassador to Saudi Arabia. He traveled with Nixon and was instrumental in opening up China for the West and is fluent in both major dialects of Chinese, Cantonese, and Mandarin, I believe.
Yeah.
Wouldn't Freeman be an ideal pick for an intelligence post rather than an ideologue?
He would indeed. You know, he does have his personal opinions, but he is an incredibly competent, qualified man. I mean, you don't run into many people, even in the foreign policy field, in the government or outside the government, who are as knowledgeable of multiple areas of the world. As you said, he speaks a couple of dialects of Chinese. He was Nixon's interpreter during his first visit to China when Freeman himself was only, I think, 29 years old, something like that. He's also an expert, somewhat of an expert, on Latin America. And then he speaks at least a little Arabic, enough to have been an interpreter for George Bush the father when he was president and when Freeman was ambassador to Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, he is incredibly qualified and I would have to say a brilliant person. And and as I said, he does have his personal opinions, but he also, in a recent interview with Philip Weiss, who's a great blogger, he spoke to Weiss after he had withdrawn his nomination. I just lost my train of thought and I forgot what I was going to say that he said. But anyway, he is, he said that he has a great deal of respect for Israel. And he almost, he did this also in an interview on CNN with Fareed Zakaria, tried to emphasize, I think too strongly, how much respect he had for Israel and at least its initial founding principles, that it was a humane society and so on. I disagree with him totally on that, but that is a personal opinion, and you can be sure that the Israel lobby people would never object to anybody in a in the kind of position that Freeman was slated for expressing that kind of bias. But they, of course, they what they objected to was that he has been quite rightly and I think quite objectively critical of Israel's policies. It's impossible to be totally objective by everyone's standards, but I think Freeman came about as close to it as is possible.
You know, there's another good thing that this whole operation has done. It is to bring back into greater public attention the two professors, Mearsheimer and Walt, who back a year or so ago now wrote an entire lengthy book on the Israel lobby. Both Wald and Mearsheimer have themselves come out with articles on the whole Freeman incident, and that, of course, gives everybody in the country an opportunity to think back again about the high quality of this book that they themselves wrote, and one hopes will encourage more people to go and read their book, which is something that the right-wing leadership of Israel hopes that no one will do. They hope that everyone will sort of forget that book, which is a splendid book.
The lobby hopes that also, that people will forget about it. But
well, that brings up a good question. Now, both of you had served in the intelligence agency for a number of years. You're both considered strong experts on not only foreign policy, but a lot of other analysis here in the United States. During your time with the agency, when you were analysts, especially you, Kathy, when you were dealing with issues on the Middle East, was there pressure from your higher-ups, from maybe significant visitors, quote-unquote, to the agency to kind of steer you in the way of favoring analysis towards Israel?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think I can honestly say, you know, Bill and I have been away from the agency for 30 years. I hate to admit that we're that old, but back in that era, during the 70s, particularly, we left the agency in 1979, which is in the 70s or the decade when I worked on the Middle East. As an analyst, I can honestly say that I never felt any pressure to avoid being critical of Israel. You know, when you write as an analyst at the CIA, you do try to be objective, and you don't use, inflammatory words, and you don't inject your opinion. But you can say, you can report on events that situations that paint a country in a bad light. And we did that. You know, I think the general opinion, personal opinion of most of the people in the branch I worked in, who worked on both Israel and the Arab states, were most of us thought that Israel was intransigent. That was the harshest thing we had to say about Israel in those days. But we were never prevented from saying that. We were never prevented from writing articles and so on, or giving analyses, writing analyses that painted Israel in that light. I think, however, and I don't know what's going on inside the CIA nowadays, but I think that things have probably changed, and it's a little more difficult, I would guess, on the basis of no inside knowledge, but just on the basis of how the public discourse is these days, I would guess it's harder for an analyst to be quite so honest nowadays.
You know, I want to add something to that, if I may. The power specifically of what we call the Israel lobby, which is a much wider group than is implied by the phrase one single lobby, because a lot of organizations are involved, and much of the Christian right in this country is involved in trying to protect the right-wing government of Israel, too. But if you look at intelligence as a whole, I think probably the domination of this particular lobby, multiple group of lobbies that we call the Israel lobby, was not really powerful until, I don't know, say the 70s or perhaps even the early 80s, although it was very damn powerful, even when Kennedy and Johnson were in office. But in other areas, the influence of politics on intelligence analysis, it's been a running thing. And in all administrations, going really all the way back to Harry Truman, there has been a lot of effort placed by certain people to become powerful in influencing what kind of intelligence reports were written. And now, you know, I started there in the 1950s, and I was very junior at that stage. But even as a junior person, you heard all sorts of rumors while President Eisenhower was in office that the two Dulles brothers, one Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, and one the head of the CIA, Allen Dulles, what you heard were rumors that these two very senior people had sort of conspired or had worked together to keep from Eisenhower information about the strength or weaknesses of the Sino-Soviet alliance. Because, of course, if you reach the conclusion that the Sino-Soviet alliance was totally unified and very strong, that meant good things for U.S. military budgets if you happen to be somebody who benefited from having high U.S. military budgets. And again, as a junior person in those years, I can't now stand here and say I know that all this happened, but there were very widespread stories that one could hear about indicating precisely that these two very top people and knew that Eisenhower was one who wanted to delegate many important problems, and in the process of delegation, that gave them the ability to have more control over the kind of intelligence information that went to the president. And again, the story, maybe that's all it was. The story was that these two people were able to prevent information going to the president that indicated, even at that time, that the USSR, top levels of the USSR and top levels in China, were nowhere near as united as many people in the U.S. military industrial complex wanted to have their president believe. So I think you have to be careful. I think there are, in all eras since World War II, there have been episodes like that. And so it's probably not correct to say, well, gee, this is a big new thing just happening now.
I have
it's just a matter of degree.
it's a matter of degree.
Yeah.
Right. You know, this whole issue brings up something that I'd like us to touch on at the moment. I've spent a considerable amount of time in the Middle East, as well as you two have, and we've all, you know, been to Palestine regularly for a number of years. We have a new president. We have a new administration. We have heard this phrase, change you can believe in, that there is a new dawn, you know, approaching, that Obama was going to be more open and more accepting of a variety of people from different walks in terms of conservatives, progressives, centrists, what have you. However, thus far in this administration, we haven't seen a lot of change. We saw a three-week horrible massacre that occurred, albeit, granted, before he was officially president, but Obama said nothing about the Gaza massacre, which left 1,400 people dead and nearly 6,000 wounded, as well as a number of accusations, not only from human rights groups, but also from the ICRC, who said that there are severe violations that the Israelis committed. In general, as well, there has been very little discussion about home demolitions. Instead of saying that they were illegal, Hillary Clinton said that they were not helpful.
Yeah.
And now with this issue of Chaz Freeman being denied simply because of his, for lack of a better term, fairness within dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, now we have him being brushed aside. What do you feel this is saying to the Arab as well as Muslim, or in general the Middle East, about U.S. foreign policy at this stage? And Kathy, let's begin with you.
Okay, I think it is sending a terrible, terrible message. It certainly is sending a terrible message to us. You know, as you mentioned his silence during the Gaza assault, which was just a horrific assault, as we all know. And Obama chose this excuse about there's only one president at a time to remain silent. And then 2 days after his inauguration, on January 22nd, he appointed George Mitchell to be special envoy. And he expressed sympathy for the plight, the humanitarian plight of Gazans, but he basically blamed Hamas for that plight and for starting the war, which is a blatant lie. I mean, just in factual terms, it's appalling, because the Israelis are the ones who broke the ceasefire and provoked some Hamas rocket fire, which in turn led to the Israeli assault. And it also, his statement also totally ignores the horrible disproportion of Israel's attack and the more than 100-to-1 kill ratio, 100 Palestinians killed for every one Israeli. So that right at the very beginning of his administration, it was a bad sign. Then, as you say, Hillary Clinton went there and she praised the Israelis and she scolded them a little bit for their unhelpful house demolitions. Well, you know, when you demolish somebody's house, not because he's a terrorist, but because he happens to be in the way of Jewish development, that is an outrage. It isn't unhelpful. It's outrageous. And the fact that the United States cannot speak to that adequately and honestly sends a terrible message, and every Arab in the Middle East knows it. And you know, the Israeli atrocities are shown much more on Arab and Muslim on the television screens in the Arab and the Muslim world than they ever are here. And of course, that's an understatement, I guess. And everybody knows that the weapons Israel used in Gaza were American weapons, and nothing is being done. 2 months later, 2 months after the end of that of the shooting war, the Israelis are still doing some shooting and killing of people in Gaza. 2 months later, the U.S. has said absolutely nothing to criticize Israel's conduct of that war, and every Arab and Muslim in the world knows it. Knows that we are still backing Israel.
You know, I think you can make a case that the degree of change, after talking about change for his whole over a year long campaign, the degree of change that Obama makes may be significant in domestic affairs, but all the meaningful evidence so far suggests that that may very well not be the case in foreign policies, and that is a tragedy. Now, just overnight, we've had a new statement issued by the White House and a video talk given to the people of Iran by the President of the United States, and in which he talks as Obama is great at talking of how he really wants to engage in very serious negotiations with the Iranian government and wants to keep things peaceful to the maximum possible extent, and hopes against hope that we can resolve this problem of Iran without hostilities. But the fact is, just a week ago, this same President Obama renewed all sorts of restrictions and heavy sanctions on the trade of all nations with Iran. So, again, I think you will see a great deal of skillfulness exercised in how Obama deals with foreign policy, but it's not a time where I can be optimistic that he's going to introduce much real change, except he has been working very clearly to sort of erase the roughest edges from what we all know of as the torture problem, quote and unquote. And I think he will continue to do that. But this is, he's talking about just getting rid of sort of the roughest edges of that.
And taking a year to close down Guantanamo and things like that.
Taking a long time to close down Guantanamo, expanding the war in Afghanistan and continuing longer than he said he would as a candidate, the war in Iraq. And so I have very little optimism left in his in my judgments of what he's going to do in foreign policy.
You know, I think you mentioned at the beginning of your question a long time ago, our long answer, that he is trying to, I forget how you put it, but he's trying to be a little more bipartisan. I think that he is actually afraid of confrontation with the very conservative and in many ways neoconservative discourse that still prevails in Washington. Conservatives are very strong. The conservative think tanks, the neoconservative think tanks are very strong still in Washington, as evidenced by what happened to Chaz Freeman. But this is across the board, not just on the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And I think he is enough of a bipartisan that he is totally afraid of confrontation with the neocons, which is why he is, as Bill mentioned, as we all know, expanding the war in Afghanistan, incidentally extending it to Pakistan, and also staying in Iraq longer and not doing anything for the Palestinians, in fact, continuing to support Israel.
I think he is totally afraid of something else, Kathy. I think he is very much wants to avoid anybody's ever possibly charging him with having been the U.S. leader mm-hmm. who lost the American Empire.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a great world hero, Winston Churchill, who felt the same way about the British Empire after World War II. And I think Obama knows that he is the president who, if he really changes foreign policies, that's what he's going to be charged with. He gave up, he lost the American Empire. Well, my goodness, it would be a wonderful thing if somebody would give it up. But I don't think it's going to be Obama.
I'd like to pose this question to both of you. Those closest to Freeman have confirmed that his decision to withdraw his name was indeed his own. Neither the president nor director of national intelligence, Dennis Blair, who had offered Freeman the position, asked him to withdraw his acceptance of the NIC post. At the same time, though, the White House's refusal to come to Freeman's defense in the face of misleading and defamatory attacks is kind of reminiscent of the Clinton White House's abandonment of Assistant Attorney General nominee Lani Gournay in similar circumstances back in 1993. Would you agree, Bill? Let's begin that with you.
I would absolutely agree. The president had it in his power to say a whole lot of things in support of Chas Freeman, and he didn't say a one of them. And I don't care that Freeman decided on his own to do what he did when he saw that he was going to become the problem rather than part of the solution. I don't know what a human being can do when he reaches that conclusion other than to throw up his hands and say, I've got to take myself out of this because I am damaging. And I think he is damaging. I think what has happened is going to damage both the world and the United States. I think it is that important.
And Kathy, what about you?
I agree totally. I think, you know, the White House may not have said explicitly fire Freeman or don't continue the appointment. That may have not have been explicit. But as you pointed out, I think Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, broadcast and boasted that he had gone to talk to Rahm Emanuel, and that Freeman's views on Israel were totally unacceptable, Schumer thought, and he had discussed this with Rahm Emanuel, and then lo and behold, what happens next? Freeman withdraws. So I think it's entirely possible that Freeman actually made the final decision, but it was so clear to him and to everybody at that point that he would get no support from the White House, from the administration he was working for, that he probably felt he just couldn't go on. He gave a statement to this article I mentioned earlier by Philip Weiss, is in the American Conservative, and just before he Freeman withdrew, he told Weiss this. He said, quote, "If the administration does not stick with me, then it is destroying the argument that the Israel lobby is only a mythic entity and does not control the public space." And I think he discovered in the weeks during which he endured these attacks, and the White House said nothing to back him up, I think he realized that the White House was willing to cave into the Israel lobby and that would have ultimately made his job impossible.
Well, Kathy, the Obama administration said it would withdraw the entire $900 million it pledged to the reconstruction of Gaza if the Palestinian Unity Government, which is attempting to form now, does not recognize Israel and renounce violence. However, no such conditions are being placed on Israel after its three-week massacre that left over 1,400 people dead and nearly 6,000 wounded. And, of course, now we've talked about the change that the Obama administration claims it is bringing to Washington, but this sounds very similar to presidents past since basically the Truman era, correct?
Well, I think I misunderstood you. What is similar to the Truman era, going back to the Truman era?
Well, in terms of like the stipulations, not necessarily with all the conditions, but nonetheless, basically since the Truman era, back in 1948, when the state was being founded, for about, let's say, a month, there was a time where the United States government, as it was watching the ethnic cleansing of Palestine happening, said that, okay, we need to have some kind of a freeze. We need to go ahead and look at this, you know, partition that's going on. Maybe we should go ahead and concentrate a little bit more strongly. At the time, the Zionists that were lobbying Washington really put pressure on. And then, of course, there was basically a house cleaning where analysts weren't involved anymore with making suggestions to the White House. Literally, the White House took over the whole situation with Israel.
Yeah.
And thus far, that's been happening again and again. And as I said, Obama's saying, well, you know, we're going to go ahead and listen to our analysts. We're going to go ahead and listen to the professionals who know about this, the foreign policy experts. But right again, you had a man who had that capability, Chaz Freeman, who has extensive experience within the Middle East, as you said, in Latin America, as well as in China. And yet he was brushed aside and basically forced out, you know, of the opportunity to be that person. And this sounds eerily similar to presidents past. And that's what I'm trying to get at is,
yes,
do you feel that that is the case?
I think you're exactly right. And I'm sorry I misunderstood you, but I'm glad I gave you a chance to lay it out more fully, because I think you did a brilliant job. I think you're exactly right that this issue, the Arab-Israeli conflict and specifically the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, has always been one that has been handled in the political arena in the United States because of the Israel lobby, rather than in substantive analytical terms by the intelligence community or the foreign policy community. I said earlier that I never felt any pressure as an analyst to avoid criticizing Israel or writing analyses that showed Israel in a critical light. But I also, and I think that was true at the time, But I also believe that the analyses that I and my colleagues wrote had very little impact on White House decisions, because there was always this domestic political pressure from the Israel lobby. And the Israel lobby defined, as I would define it loosely, the way Mearsheimer and Walt defined it, as a loose coalition of individuals and organizations who, I forget their exact words, but whose primary objective is to direct U.S. policy in a pro-Israeli direction, meaning that it is not just AIPAC. It's a matter of the public discourse and how policy is influenced. This sort of lobby discourse, lobby-imposed discourse, has been in place since Truman, as you said. And it has it has had a cumulative effect. It has become more and more and more so, more and more and more pro-Israeli and anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, as the years and the administrations have gone on. And it was worse by a matter of several degrees in the Bush administration. And it's, we can talk about how, and I agree with what Bill said earlier, that the fact of this incident and the lobby's blatant behavior in getting rid of Freeman has helped open debate on it, helped also by the Mearsheimer-Walt book of a couple of years ago. But and that's very true, and I think in many ways the lobby is running scared, by their because of their shrill tactics, that these are an indication that they're running scared. But the fact is, they still have Congress, and they still have the executive. And until we can overcome that, we're not going to get very far, I'm afraid.
Well, how do we overcome that? That was actually going to be my next question. Is there anyone in Congress right now who's willing, with the exception of the usual suspects such as Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul and a few others who voice opposition, is there anyone or any kind of a group of congressmen and women who are standing up and saying, wait a minute, basically we can't go along as business as usual. This is not helpful for us, for Israel, or for our objectives in the Middle East?
I don't think yet. There were these two congressmen who went to Gaza shortly, I guess about a month ago, shortly after the Gaza assault had ended, Brian Baird of Washington State and Keith Ellison, the only Muslim in Congress from Indiana. And
Minnesota, actually.
Huh?
Keith Ellison's from the 4th District of Minnesota.
Oh, he is?
Yes.
Oh, that's right. My gosh, I've been saying Indiana for some time. Yeah, you're right. Anyway, thank you. But the two of them, and particularly Baird, have been very strong in their statements. They apparently held a confab, a little conference, public conference, like a press conference, I guess, in the Capitol building after they got back to describe what they had seen and so on. And I think that's very good. But it's also a very small effort. Two more congressmen to add to Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich isn't going to take us very far unless they can keep up the pressure and hopefully get more people more congressmen to join them. So far, I'm not terribly hopeful. It was congressmen, the seven Republican members of the House Intelligence Committee, who, even though Freeman was not, his appointment was not subject to Senate confirmation, maybe these were seven Republican senators rather than congressmen, but in any case, they spoke up and said that they also opposed his nomination, even though the Senate really had nothing to do with his appointment. So there's still a whole lot to overcome, and some days I'm hopeful, but other days I'm not at all hopeful.
And Bill, what's your view on this?
Yeah, well, it's very much like Kathy's. I would be even stronger in arguing that the only way we are going to ever get the Congress, the majority of the Congress, both the House and the Senate, out from under this Israel lobby is to make happen a great groundswell of opinion against what has happened in this incident and in others. You know, how is it going to ever happen that somebody else will be appointed to the job that Freeman had and gave up? who is going to take that job, who will be anything other than a non-entity. He will either be known as a direct supporter of Israel or a non-entity. I think that entire position is going to be a dead position for a long time. But more than that, as I mentioned way back at the start, the individual national intelligence officers, each covering certain areas of the world or certain particular topics. For instance, there's an NIO for oil or for the energy industry globally. But there will be terrible fear in these 16 people, or maybe now it's up to 20. I don't know how many NIOs there are now. Maybe it's down to 12. But there will be a terrible fear in the mind of every one of them if they are in the sort of the middle of their career or nearing the end of it, but have kids to put through college. They're going to be very, very careful about doing anything in opposition to this lobby, which has recently shown such power. That's where the real danger of this thing is, and I think the only way to combat that is to get a groundswell of public opinion in this country that there should not be this kind of domination of U.S. foreign policy by any particular group or any particular nation. I'll stop there.
Okay, let me. I do have one hopeful thing to say. There is, I wouldn't call it a groundswell, but there is more public consciousness of the, you know, the horrors that Israel perpetrated in Gaza and does in general direct through the entire its entire occupation of the West Bank as well. And there are some small groups forming to stop the you know, the $30 billion of aid that have been pledged to Israel for over the next 10 years and to stop aid to Israel in general, stop support for Israel. We may be in a too progressive a bubble here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and in Albuquerque, but there are one in Albuquerque, one in Santa Fe, new groups, each calling themselves another Jewish voice, and they're one is entirely Jewish, the other is largely Jewish, which have formed themselves as small lobby organizations against specifically to oppose AIPAC and its influence. And also in Albuquerque, and this is a group Bill and I are working with, there's a group working under the aegis of the U.S. campaign to stop the occupation, to end the occupation, which is based in Washington. We formed an organization to try to help stop the $30 billion arms package, 10-year arms package to Israel. Now, these are very small efforts. We're all very dedicated and so on, but on the Stop 30 Billion group, we are the only Santa Feans who go down to Albuquerque to meet every 2 weeks, and we're just at the beginning stages. But we all have arranged or are trying to arrange meetings with senators and congressmen, and have written an article in the paper and letters to the editor and so on. But it's a small effort of maybe a couple dozen people in one city.
And then I'd like to close with this question directed at both of you. And Kathy, we'll start with you. Freeman is now officially out of the running for the head of the Intelligence Council. Where do you think George Mitchell's fate might lie in all of this? Many in Washington have very nervous feelings about him because he is a fair-minded negotiator. He did negotiate the Good Friday talks that finally ended the conflict between the IRA and the British. Is there a chance that the likes of Hillary Clinton will overshadow Mitchell to appease the neocons and Zionist lobbies? Earlier in our interview, we talked about how she used the phrase unhelpful as opposed to illegal, demolishing of Palestinian Israeli homes. Is there a chance that she will now basically overcome Mitchell within his appointment to possibly be there to negotiate a peaceful settlement with the Palestinians?
I think there's a real chance of that, and I have no confidence at all in anything Hillary Clinton does. The use of the word unhelpful is totally meaningless. It is hardly even to be characterized as gentle criticism. It is so gentle as to be meaningless. And the only hope I see is that Obama himself will change. And as I mentioned earlier, the degree of my hope has declined by the day since he actually passed Inauguration Day and became the president. I see I had a lot of hope at that. Well, I had some. I had real hope. I had significant hope at that time. And the only thing that has happened since then is that the amount of hope that I have for real change in U.S. foreign policy has diminished day by day, and I think this is what has to change. We have to keep people from being distracted, keep them focused on the Middle East and on the issues of the Middle East, and keep emphasizing what an absolutely uncivilized behavior has occurred in Gaza, which the U.S. is largely paying for and heavily responsible for, and maybe we can compel Obama to do something, but that's the only hope I see, that somehow all of us who want to see more justice in this problem succeed in persuading him to change. He is our president for the next 4 years.
You know, I think that Mitchell is operating under several handicaps. The first one is that his boss, his most direct boss, is Hillary Clinton, as you pointed out. And I think if I wouldn't be at all surprised if she were to actively thwart him, should he be go too far off the reservation in terms of pressure, trying to pressure Israel. He also, and Ali Abu Nima has pointed this out, when he did negotiated the Northern Ireland agreement, he had the U.S. government behind him and the Irish-American lobby. In this case, he has the U.S. government certainly not wholly supportive of any steps that he would have to take in order to demands he would have to make of Israel in order to bring about a resolution, and he certainly does not have the pro-Israel lobby behind him. And the third handicap, I think, is Mitchell himself. I think that he is approaching this problem as he did when he was appointed in 2001, or actually late 2000 by Clinton, the Mitchell Commission that looked into this issue back then at the beginning of the Intifada. He is approaching this as if the two sides were equal, as an effort to treat both sides equally and get a more or less equal solution. And of course the situation is not equal. The power imbalance is just incredible. The Palestinians have nothing to give. If there is to be a solution, a two-state solution, the Israelis are the only ones who have anything to give. They have to get out of the West Bank. They have to get out of the settlements. They have to withdraw to the 67 lines. And you realize just in repeating that how impossible that's going to be. And the Palestinians have nothing to give because they have nothing. So the situation is not equal, and it cannot be approached as a conflict between equals. And I'm afraid that's what Mitchell is inclined to do.
And we are going to leave it there. Our guests today have been Kathleen and Bill Christensen. Kathleen Christensen is a former CIA political analyst who has worked on Middle East issues for over 35 years and is the author of Perceptions of Palestine and The Wound of Dispossession. Bill Christensen is a former senior official of the CIA and also served as a national intelligence officer and as director of the CIA's Office of Regional and Political Analysis. Kathleen and Bill Christensen, as always, it's a pleasure, and thank you again for joining us today on Crossing the Line.
Thank you very much, Don.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You have been listening to Crossing the Line, which is produced by members of the Podcast Collective at the studios of 94.1 KPFA Radio in Berkeley, California. Special thanks to news producer George Ushmawi, segment producer Ali Budner, contributing producers Mumia Abu-Jamal, Rami Almagari, Scott Berguin, Quiva Butterly, and Nora Barrows-Friedman. From all of us here, we thank you so much for your continued support. In Berkeley, this is Najee Ali for Crossing the Line. Signing off.